What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint. Yeah, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah.
And welcome into the Legal Face-Off. This is Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini, and Michael Heidemann in for Sam Panionovich today. There's a lot happening in the news, and let's get right into it. Talking about the Supportive Release Center, we welcome Sheriff Dart, Tom Dart, to the show. Sheriff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Thanks, Sheriff Dart. You've been sheriff in Cook County since 2006. You oversee the nation's largest single-site jail, among other things. You oversee a population of over 12,000 inmates. Tell us about the partnership that you've entered into with the University of Chicago. What is the health lab, and how has it been so far in the short existence it's been around?
Yeah, you know, it was an idea that we have been working on in different capacities here for the last 5 years or so, where the whole notion was people leaving this jail, frankly, any jail, if you just dump them in the streets, you can pretty much set your watch by the hour that they'll be coming back into custody. So we need to stabilize people, help them with housing, and sort of, you know, in some respects, hold their hands. And so the Supportive Release Center is the latest iteration, but this is the cool thing about it is before I was doing it sort of just with my own resources and my own staff, this is University of Chicago, TASC, the Heartland Alliance, and private funding paying for this service. So it's fantastic.
So, Sheriff, what has historically been done before the Supportive Release Center opened? What had historically been done to help people who have mental health issues transition back into society? And what does the center strive to do differently?
You know, the thing that I find amazing that here in the, you know, well into the 21st century, that you would think by now that we would have learned that when people are involved with the criminal justice system, you know, whether you like them or not, that if you don't come up with thoughtful interventions when they leave, they'll come right back in and cost you a lot of money. And so as we stand here now, jails throughout the entire country, almost all of them do the same thing, is that they get a court order from a judge to release someone either because they pled guilty or their case was dropped, and literally you open the door and they walk out. And then everyone scratches their head and acts surprised why this mentally ill person, this homeless person, this person that had nowhere to live, that had other substance abuse issues, I wonder why they're getting involved with crime again. And so about 7 years ago, I started doing discharge planning as if this was like a hospital. So I'd put plans together for people. I got vans donated to me so I'd help drive people to shelters and drive them home. What this does, though, is it brings in the private sector with those other people I mentioned, the UFC and TASC and Heartland, with their money to help me do that same thing. So there's just this very thoughtful process when people leave, as opposed to literally what's going on around the country right now is they open the door and they literally walk to the street at all hours of the day and night.
It's interesting, Sheriff Dart, because later on in the show we have the Erie County, New York, district attorney on to discuss the nation's first opioid court. He'll be discussing the rise of drug courts as an alternative to sentencing people with opioid addiction, which, as you know, is a huge problem nationwide. Do you see that sort of along the same lines as what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should mention that. We started over a year and a half ago, which I think is the only thing program like this in the country. So you ought to mention it to them because it's working out very well so far, is we identify individuals based on them coming into our custody who have opioid issues, usually it's because they're having to go into detox. And what we do then is we train them in how to use naloxone. And we train them. We then require that they're in a substance abuse program. And then when they leave us, we give them two canisters of naloxone when they leave, because I started looking at all the numbers, and Cermak Hospital has been very helpful on this as well. When someone leaves the custody of a jail, it is outrageous the spike in overdoses that occur, because they've been kept clean, obviously, because they're in a jail, and many of them go right back to the same location, the same issues, and their systems can't take it. So the overdose numbers go through the roof then. And so what we've been doing is trying to get out in front of that by utilizing naloxone, training individuals, and we've had a real positive impact. But it's the same concept with the release center, which is to be thoughtful here. Deal with the subjects you have in front of you, the issues they have, and what are thoughtful strategies that we can implement to prevent them from either coming back in or harming themselves.
How long in your experience so far, how long do folks tend to stay at the center? And what are some of the different ways that folks are assessed in determining whether or not they are ready to move on from the center?
You know, they have a nurse that's on full-time, a doctor that's on full-time. We do workups ourselves well before they're taken to the center. So when they're brought into our custody, we work them up. And for individuals who have mental illnesses and substance abuse, we treat them very much like a patient. And so they're in programs with us here. We do discharge planning in anticipation of them leaving. And then when they fit the category, which is basically someone with a mental health issue, someone who's homeless, someone has a substance abuse problem, then they're given the option to go over to the release center to finish what we have been working on while they're with us. And when they're there, they're given, you know, a warm meal. They're given place to wash their clothes. They're allowed to stay there up to 2 nights. And during that time, the center is working feverishly to connect them with housing, connect them with programming on the outside for the mental health or for substance abuse issues. And so it's voluntary. You know, once their case is over and they want to leave, I can't make them go there. But usually we've built up a rapport with them where they trust us, they know what we're trying to do here, and they want to go there. So it can hold up to 12 people at a time now. And we've only had this up and running for about a month. And we've already had 75 people that we've served, and it's all men so far. Our goal is in very short order to see if we can get a women's component in place as well, though.
Sheriff Dart, if we can switch gears really quickly, we'll be talking in a few minutes about the reinstatement of the Cook County sweetened beverage tax. You were very vocal in talking about the need to lay off 925 of your employees as a result of this cut. You said that it was beyond reckless to ask you to lay off that amount of people. You were worried about public safety. Now that the tax is back on effective today, are those concerns allayed? Did you recall those people, or did you, you know, not have to lay them off at all?
You know, it's interesting, and I'm not in any way blaming the county officials on this. I know they weren't looking to have this tax, you know, put on hold for a month. But I think as a result of that, too, everyone's in sort of uncharted territory. So we're not sure is the best way I can tell you right now. We were told that anybody who hasn't been physically laid off yet, we could rescind that. But we had already laid off some people. So we're trying to get clarity on whether or not we can pull all that back or whether or not we have to go through with it. There still is a funding gap of that they also aren't certain of yet. There is going to have to be made up, and we're confident we can reach that because we had been looking at this horrific number that really was reckless. We couldn't operate that way, and so we know that we can come up with this other number if we just freeze some things for a short period of time. It'll cause us some problems. Don't get me wrong; it will definitely cause us some problems, but not of the nature that we're facing. But a long answer to your short question is no one is quite sure yet on how this is going to play out yet. I think we'll know in the next few days.
An ongoing process, lots of great work. That is Sheriff Dart doing great work here in Cook County and beyond. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Legal Face-Off today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey and Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
All right, welcome into the Legal Face-Off. There's a lot of great topics. We're rolling right along. There was recently a shooting which happened in Minneapolis, and I wanted to get some insight with Rich and Tina. We welcome Chief Jim Bierman to the show. He was 33 years at the Redlands Police Department, and he retired in 2011. We welcome Jim to the show, Chief Jim Bierman. How's it going today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Jim, you are an expert in police procedure. We want to talk a little bit about this shooting that happened, as Mike mentioned, in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago now that has gotten a lot of national attention for lots of different reasons. Lots of different factors, I think, coalesced to make this a unique shooting in some ways. We had a African-American, a Somali officer who was involved in the shooting. He shot a Australian national, a white female. He reached across from the passenger seat and shot Justine Damon across the seat where his partner was sitting. He also didn't agree, I think to date has not agreed to be interviewed. So could you address some of those factors, all of which I think are fairly unusual?
Sure, it is unusual. We don't know a lot about the case because much of the information hasn't been released, but I think police practitioners certainly would tell you that this is unusual for an officer to fire that close to his partner is very odd and unusual. It does not mean that it wasn't an appropriate thing for him to do given other circumstances. I think it's very difficult for anybody to look at this and say that this is anything but an unbelievable tragedy, but we don't know enough about the circumstances, what was going through the officer's mind, what he was thinking at the time he pulled the trigger. And all of that is relevant from a legal standpoint, maybe not from a layman's perspective where you just look at this and go, what was this guy thinking? How could you shoot somebody that was trying to help the police help somebody else? But the legal standard in this country is a seminal Supreme Court ruling, and that ruling tells us that you cannot judge an officer's actions or use of force with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, but in fact, you must look at the information that the officer had at the time, his training and experience, and the facts available to him and what his perceptions were, and that must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer given the same training experience and understanding of the facts at the time. And that explains, by the way, in this world that we're in now, why we have very controversial officer-involved shootings that are ultimately deemed to be justified under the standard. It's Graham versus Connor. But people's common sense looks at this and says that can't be justified. It can't be a reasonable shooting. And why is the officer not being charged or fired? And so there's a disconnect between what the rules are that tell the police when to use force and the common understanding and perception of that. And this is one of the many reasons that people get so upset when they read about these things.
Well, and, you know, this is another example of, you know, a contentious police shooting. I think all of us know the case of Philando Castile well. That was where he got shot during a traffic stop in a suburb of St. Paul last summer. And, you know, there's a question that I think has crossed the minds of some about whether there's something going on with respect to the Twin Cities police force because of the controversial nature of these two shootings relatively close in time to each other. There have been reports of orange signs appearing around town warning of easily startled police. What do you think is going on here?
I don't know what's going on in your region. It could be something very specific. It could just be part of this broader trend that officers, I think, are concerned about their personal safety. There have been a series of ambush attacks in Dallas, Baton Rouge, New York City, had a couple of them. And police officers consume information about those kinds of incidents the same way everybody else does on their mobile devices. They get it in almost real time. So what used to be a regional bit of news that affected the way cops view things, I think now space and time has been eliminated, and it doesn't matter where you are in the country, your mobile device is going to tell you about this thing, and you're going to get it real time, and you're going to get access to social media sites that are specific to police officers. And it's possible that we've elevated this level of apprehension to in police officers to a point where sometimes they do things that are just not reasonable.
Vastly important work. Really interesting story. That was Chief Jim Bierman. He was with the Redlands Police Department for 33 years. We want to promote the Police Foundation, which was meant to improve policing through innovation and science. Jim, Chief Bierman, it was great having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
Welcome back to the Legal Face-Off. You know, an increasingly important problem and an issue that's happening here in the United States is the opioid crisis that's happening. And we welcome District Attorney John Flynn to the show. John, how's it going today?
Very good. Thank you.
John, thanks so much for joining us today. We're looking forward to our conversation. We'd like to kick things off by talking about what the opioid crisis looks like. We've been hearing a lot about it, particularly over the past couple of years. What does this look like in Buffalo and in Erie County?
Well, just like the rest of the nation, Tina, it's dire. We are averaging probably a person a day, an individual a day, who is dying of a opiate overdose death here in Erie County in the city of Buffalo. I don't know what the numbers are per day across the nation, but I can tell you here in Buffalo, it's reached epidemic proportions where, like I said, we're losing one a day.
So starting May 1st of this year, in reaction to that epidemic, your county and a judge in your county started the nation's first opioid crisis intervention court. Tell us what that is and how it's worked so far.
It's working great so far. We had a drug court in the city of Buffalo for the past 20 years, and we were seeing that the drug court did not work. Approximately 1 to 2 people who were going through our drug court were dying per week of an opioid overdose. So the problem with the opioid crisis here in a normal drug court is, you know, it took 2 or 3, sometimes a month, to get that individual into treatment. The main difference with the opioid intervention court is the individual is in treatment on day one. So as soon as that person gets arrested, they're identified as having an opioid a problem, they are immediately brought up for the first court appearance, which is arraignment, before the city court judge. And if I basically buy off on it, I will agree to let that person out of jail, no bail, and go into a treatment facility right there on day one, and then adjourn the case until that individual has gone through the treatment.
So what do you think has been working well so far for you, and what do you think are some of the challenges based on the past couple of months?
Well, Tina, I can tell you that as far as I'm concerned, this is working well so far because we haven't lost one individual yet. Not one person who has entered the opioid court has lost their life to this problem. And so to me, that right there is indication of success immediately. What works, I think, is, again, getting the person into treatment right away, not having them, you know, out for a couple weeks before their next court appearance. I think that the fact that they're in right away is saving lives here, quite frankly.
Mr. District Attorney, or John, as you asked us to call you, the key to the success so far of this program also seems to involve City Court Judge Craig Hanna, who presides over the program. I saw a story, I believe it was on NBC Nightly News, featuring this program, and Judge Hanna, I was very impressed with his devotion with, you know, he just seemed to care very much about the people who were going through this program and didn't just see them as, you know, numbers or as criminals.
That's absolutely true. He is the perfect judge to handle this program. Judge Hanna, he's been on the bench now for over 10 years. He knows the city of Buffalo. He's born and raised in the city of Buffalo, you know, grew up in one of the toughest neighborhoods here in the city of Buffalo, and he is the perfect judge to handle this program. And his court and my office, along with the medical people who are involved in the program, we're all working hand in hand as a team here to see what we can do to help solve this crisis.
So how easily do you think that this court can be replicated elsewhere? I mean, you're doing some tremendous work for the community. It sounds like it's been very effective so far. I'm sure a lot of different jurisdictions are watching what you're doing. How easily do you think this can be replicated?
I think it can be replicated pretty easily. The key, though, is obviously, you know, you have to have a court system. You know, whether or not it's a city court, where you're at there in the city of Chicago, or some type of county court, you know, in Cook County, you know, someone, you know, a court has to agree to take this on. So that's the first step right there. The second step is the district attorney's office, you know, where you are in Cook County there or nationwide, has to agree on a couple things. One, they have to agree on allowing the individual to get let out of jail right away. So obviously, this program is only going to be acceptable from my standpoint for certain crimes. Obviously, I can't let a murderer who perhaps, you know, is charged with murder, this individual may have an opioid problem, you know, an heroin problem, but the fact that they, you know, have allegedly committed a murder, I can't let them, you know, out of jail and go, you know, to an inpatient program, unfortunately. You know, I have a duty to protect society, too, in my community. So, you know, it only works for certain nonviolent, low-level offenses. But even for nonviolent, low-level offenses, you know, I still have to agree on letting the individual out without bail. So that's number one right there. And then the second thing that the DA's office has to agree upon is an indefinite adjournment. You know, so I don't know how long this person is going to be in a program for. You know, he could be in a 30-day program, a 45-day program, 60-day program, you know, whatever. Obviously, Judge Hanna monitors the individual, you know, on a sometimes daily, weekly basis, and we're involved in that monitoring to a certain extent, too. But, you know, I basically, as a DA, have to agree to let the matter just indefinitely be adjourned from the legal standpoint while the individual gets the treatment. So as long as the DA buys off on that, as long as there's a court willing to do it, it can be replicated anywhere across the country.
John, we'll leave you with this question. Patrick Kane, Chicago Blackhawk,
yes,
superstar, is from your neck of the woods.
He is, born and raised in Buffalo, New York.
Do you think the Sabres will ever be successful in luring Kane back to his hometown to
finish his
career? Is that ever going to happen? I think we know the answer in this studio, but what's your take on that?
For our sake, I hope so. because we haven't been in the playoffs in a number of years here, both on the Sabres front and the Bills front. So we're dying for a playoff team here in Buffalo on both ends there, and we hope that someday we can get Patrick Kane in a Sabres uniform. Absolutely.
Helping both the NHL and the opioid crisis. What the work you're doing is extremely important, and you know, we wish you all the best in what you're doing and furthering this great cause that you've taken under, John.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you reaching out to me and the time we spent on this. Absolutely.
Absolutely. That was Erie County District Attorney John Flynn. The work that he does is vastly important, and we thank you again for joining us on the show today. And rolling right along on the Legal Face-Off, we have Professor Stephen Daniels, who is a senior research professor at the American Bar Foundation. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin. He also has written a book, Tort Reform, Plaintiffs, Lawyers, and Access to Justice. And that's what we have him here today to talk about, tort reforms and plaintiff lawyers. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you.
Professor, thanks for joining us. So in the Wall Street Journal article in which we were quoted, the gist of it was that the era of tort lawsuits is waning. Tell us why.
Well, the gist of that article and a lot of the work I've done trying to get a handle on what's happened to these cases, really we looked at the lawyers themselves, the gatekeepers, and a lot of the tort reform movement, which goes back a good almost 30 years now, of course, has been geared towards cutting off tort suits, and a lot of that has been done in a way that makes it economically difficult for plaintiffs' lawyers who work on a contingency fee to be able to make enough money off of their cases to stay in business. So the idea being hit the gatekeepers and close the courthouse doors.
So, Professor, beyond just the impact on lawyers and how busy their dockets are or are no longer, what are some of the other consequences of having fewer torts lawsuits being filed?
Well, part of it goes to, I think, the idea of accountability. I mean, one of the things that the civil justice system does is offer remedies for wrongdoing and accountability. If the lawsuits don't come, if people can't file them or they're no longer able to afford to, we lose that idea of accountability and responsibility that the tort system provides. The other side of it, of course, is that there are certain identifiable sets of people who may have legitimate claims and won't be able to get them remedied. They won't be able to get into the courthouse.
Professor, for our listeners, tort lawsuits, we're talking about personal injury lawsuits for the most part. I practice in this area. I defend my clients against tort lawsuits, often, very frivolous ones. I think lots of tort lawsuits have received a lot of attention over the years, be it the McDonald's hot coffee case, which, as you know, wasn't really all the public perceived it to be. That's a good example. But you did a study, you co-wrote a Texas study that had some statistics. Tell us about those. And also, I want to point out one of the statistics from the Wall Street Journal article from July 24th that underlines this issue. In 2015, fewer than 2 in 1,000 people filed tort lawsuits. And again, these are lawsuits for car accidents, for medical malpractice, for defective products. So 2 out of 1,000 in 2015 versus just 20 years ago in 1993, when 10 in 1,000 Americans filed such lawsuits.
I mean, we looked at Texas. We could track the filing of tort suits over a fair amount of time because of the records that are kept by the state of Texas. And after the middle 90s, we saw a dramatic decline in filings for tort cases, and especially for auto cases, auto crash cases, which are far and away the largest proportion of personal injury suits. And they went down significantly after the middle 90s. And there was nothing to suggest that there were fewer accidents in Texas involving injuries and death. So the raw material was still there. But the cases were just not coming into court at all. And so the issue is what was happening that meant those cases that would have come before weren't getting there. And, the idea that somehow they were all or mostly frivolous and that's what left the system doesn't seem to be backed up by reality. Most tort suits are not frivolous. Simply because you lose a personal injury suit doesn't mean it was a frivolous case.
To what extent, though, do you think that perhaps plaintiffs or potential plaintiffs were pursuing remedies pre-lawsuits? So, for example, maybe sending some sort of letter, reaching out to the potential defendant and saying, this happened, let's try to figure this out before a lawsuit was filed. To what extent do you think there was some of that going on?
Oh, I think there was a lot. I mean, everything we know about tort filings going back in time as well as more recent says that most most issues that get filed or even before that get settled. It's never been the case that most lawsuits or most issues go to a trial. The vast majority of them leave the system some other way, either through a settlement or cases just drop. But actually going to trial is a rare phenomenon and always has been. Most things get settled.
Professor, how much of the decrease in tort lawsuits is a good thing? On the one hand, you know, someone in my position who sees daily a lot of frivolous lawsuits. I know what you mentioned about frivolous, but, you know, I certainly have a vantage point on what I consider very, you know, a lot of frivolous lawsuits against my clients, not all of them, but many of them, versus I think you alluded earlier to the benefit of personal injury lawsuits dating back to, you know, a century ago. Litigation is often the way to have important change in society. You know, I don't think we would have things that we take for granted today, like seatbelts, like airbags, like safety switches on heavy machinery, without either litigation or the threat of litigation.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting part of our legal system that despite a lot of, you know, contemporary complaints about regulation, it was never all that much of a regulated system, and the civil justice system was the way in which there would be regulation. If you think all the way back 100 years or more to the types of issues you're talking about, it was because of the lawsuits that we did get some sense of regulation, and some things were remedied that, you know, were perceived as a problem and stuff. So there's always an upside to the way in which we do things, but I think the idea of civil lawsuits is, you know, it's kind of the idea of, well, we don't want the government to directly regulate. It becomes kind of a self-help type of thing. But the law, bit by bit, builds up a set of rules based around real incidences that help to bring about safety, and whether it's, you know, machinery for work, whether it's seatbelts for cars, whether it's safer pharmaceuticals or the like. You know, the problem, of course, always, it's not a perfect system. It's got its ups and downs, and it's, you know, got its problems, and tinkering with it is what we have generally done in the past and stuff. But it is, at its heart, kind of a rough and ready, imperfect way of doing things.
That is Professor Stephen Daniels, Senior Research Professor at the American Bar Foundation. You can check out his book, Tort Reform, Plaintiffs, Lawyers, and Access to Justice. All really interesting, really great topics, and it's good to know more about the tort reform and what the process is going through. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us here on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
And we end each show, as we always do, with everyone's favorite segment, the Legal Grab Bag. I'm very excited to be a part of this right now. We're talking Cook County soda tax, which is affecting a lot of people here in the city. Scaramucci.
The Mooch.
He's back in the news.
Scaramucci.
Man, this guy's taking over left and right. Gwen Stefani, Quincy Jones, and so much more. Let's get started with that Cook County soda tax. What's going on?
Yeah, breaking news. We covered the soda tax one or two shows ago with Tanya Trish, who is the general counsel for the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. They filed suit against Cook County trying to stop the soda tax. They initially won. They convinced a Cook County judge to hold on that tax, and just last week they lost. So now the tax is going to affect today. But the Illinois Retail Merchants Association yesterday filed an appeal, again, trying to stop the county from imposing this tax. So there will be continued litigation about it, but for now the tax is proceeding. Lots of people are unhappy with the tax. It is a penny per ounce, technically a sweetened beverage tax. So it applies to any non-alcoholic beverage that is either sugar or artificially sweetened, which means fountain drinks, bottled and canned beverages, soda, diet soda, teas, coffee, sports drinks. But it doesn't apply to drinks that are 100% fruit or vegetable juice. So lots of confusion, I think, about that. But the bottom line is that Heidemann 64-ounce Code Red Mountain Dew is going to be a little more expensive.
I can't live without my Mountain Dew, and I'm sure that those LaCroix fans all over the city are going bonkers right now, the fact that this is happening to the city.
Tina?
Well, $200 million, though, apparently is on the line here for Cook County, so that's a lot of money. That's a lot more money than was originally projected, so very
Tina,
big
what's your what's your sweetened beverage of choice? Are you a iced coffee person?
I do like iced coffee.
Yeah.
I don't drink a whole lot of soda, so I tend to drink sweetened tea when I drink.
You know that I've never tasted coffee in my life?
Get out.
People find that
shocking,
but I've never tasted coffee.
Mr. Energy?
Yeah, I was going to say Mr. Lankoff.
It's all natural.
I can't imagine what you'd be like if you were caffeinated.
Never tasted it. Hate the smell. Hate everything about it. Mike, what's your go-to? I think you have some mystery juice over there. We don't want to say it on the air because it's probably banned by the FDA and several. What is going on in that?
Just drinking some unicorn blood over here. You can buy it at every local Walmart. This is what we call an amino acid drink. So I'm really into those health plant-based drinks, but this does have a lot of sugar. This is like 3 cups of coffee right now.
Is it really?
Mm-hmm.
Heidemann and his sound sessions partner, Kevin Richter, are always going head-to-head on who's bigger that day, who's more jacked up, right?
It's true. It's true.
The cover picture for Sound Sessions looks like the cover of Men's Fitness or something.
I was trying to emulate the Legal Face-Off.
Oh, yeah. Sheer brawn.
Exactly. All right, let's keep moving before we talk more about Heidemann's workout regimen.
Now let's move to something that's a little less controversial and entertaining, Scaramucci.
Mm-hmm. This man has been dominating the news cycle.
Scaramucci, the now former White House communications director. He lasted all of 10 days. Went to Harvard Law School. That's why we're covering it here on Legal Face-Off. We like to have our Trump watch every week. And Scaramucci, who we all know was either let go or left or whatever, fired by Trump recently, a couple days ago. A couple of interesting stories from a legal perspective. First of all, Harvard reported him as dead.
He got the asterisk.
Yeah, he not only was fired by the White House, but in the Harvard Law School alumni directory, he was listed as deceased. He graduated from Harvard allegedly in 1989, and then they called him dead as of the last time he was published in 2011. They have since corrected either what was a prank or a typo. Also, Scaramucci, as I mentioned, graduated from Harvard in 1989, and he was then, as he is now, he was a big personality, as described by his classmates. One of them said that he was funnier and smarter version of his boss, and apparently he also made fun as a 2L of one of his professors. One of his professors asked him a tough question, and Scaramucci replied, "Well, I'd be glad to answer, but first could you tell me where you got that great haircut?" So even back then, Scaramucci was pissing people off to no end. But
he wins brownie points, I guess, for proposing to his girlfriend on a Times Square billboard. So, I guess, if you're into that sort of thing.
That's how he did it, huh?
But then divorced her by text. Then just that last week congratulated on the birth of their son by text. So
I don't know how Trump finds these guys. He has to have some research team to find the biggest personalities he can.
Yeah.
Because this is getting ridiculous.
Well, welcome them on our show, though. Scaramucci wants a gig. We'll take him on our show.
All right, let's move along from our good friend Scaramucci to our other great singer. She's bananas for a lot of things. It's Gwen Stefani. A Trample fan actually is suing her right now.
Yeah, so Gwen Stefani and her concert promoter and operator got sued by a fan, Lisa Stickland, who last July got injured at a concert that was a Gwen Stefani concert in Charlotte, North Carolina. Stefani purportedly encouraged fans at that concert who were seated on the lawn to come into the reserved section of the pavilion and to just fill in anywhere they like. So what happened was the crowd, you know, understandably rushed the stage. Mm-hmm. And Stickland, who was seated in the pavilion area, ended up suffering a broken tibia. So the lawsuit accuses Stefani of negligence. So I don't know about you guys. I know that Richie here goes to a lot of shows. I'm not so sure that I agree that Gwen Stefani should be sued here for negligence. I mean, I can't say that what she said was particularly a good thing to be saying, but I've been to concerts where a lot worse was encouraged. Let me just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for a negligence lawsuit, she would have had to have a duty. That's the key to any negligence lawsuit. We talked about tort reform earlier. Duty is the key to negligence. So a jury would have to find that Gwen Stefani owed a duty to the injured fan to protect her, or, you know, not do something negligent. So I think it's a great example of a frivolous lawsuit, of course, like we talked about earlier. I actually defend a lot of I've got some concert promoter clients, as well as I represent some venues. So I see these kind of cases all the time. I've got lots of cases involving fights at concerts, right? I mean, go to a fight, have a bunch of beers, some guy in front of you doesn't like a Gwen Stefani song.
I don't know how.
So you fight, right? And they sue everybody. They sue, in this case, Gwen Stefani. My clients are always sued because mm-hmm. they are the deep-pocketed venue owner or the concert promoter mm-hmm. or the security company. It's usually nonsense, and the good news is usually the people are drunk,
right?
Which is a great defense to someone's ridiculous lawsuit. But, yeah, I agree that that shh is bananas.
Did
B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
You? Mm-hmm. So one of the craziest concerts I remember going to was 1992 Lollapalooza when Ministry was on the stage. I don't know if anybody was there, but the fans on the lawn were throwing sod.
Wow.
I looked in the back. You know, I was in the pavilion. I look back, and I see just massive amounts of mud being thrown. And I'm thinking, something bad must have happened.
That's a Lollapalooza standard.
You know, none of this would ever happen at a Springsteen concert.
Exactly.
Never.
Let's point that out.
Sessler will testify to that. All right, let's keep going. What do we got here?
Move along to Quincy Jones, who's awarded $9.4 million in a lawsuit.
Yeah, Quincy Jones sued the estate of Michael Jackson. He claimed that they owed him $30 million in royalties from the Cirque du Soleil, a couple of Cirque du Soleil shows, and the concert film, the This Is It concert film that was completed after Michael Jackson's death. He asked the jury for this $30 million. He claimed that the estate had improperly re-edited some songs to cut him out of his royalties. The jury disagreed, not to the extent that he wanted, but they awarded him, instead of the $392,000 that the Jackson estate said he was owed, they awarded him $9.4 million in royalties. And Quincy Jones hailed this as a victory for artists.
Yes.
I think the family is going to appeal it, they've said.
Yes, that's true. I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't for the fact that Thriller and Bad and Off the Wall were, you know, three of the most unbelievably successful albums in the history of music.
All produced by Quincy Jones, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The interesting thing was that the estate's attorneys pointed out that Quincy Jones made $3 million in the 2 years before Michael Jackson died off right. of these royalties, but $8 million in the 2 years after his death. So that shows their argument went that he wasn't really entitled to this money because he was making more after Michael Jackson died. Big payday for Quincy Jones. Victory, if you follow that perspective, for artists. Favorite Michael Jackson song, Mike Heideman? I know you're a huge Jacko fan.
Always been, since the day I was born. You don't have to say, I kind of always, I don't know, because do you want to go with the young Michael, which had
yeah.
so many great hits? Mm-hmm. I'm going to just stick with a classic, Billie Jean, Let's Do That, or Smooth Criminal was always good.
Man,
oh,
you stole
Smooth
my,
Criminal's
you,
awesome.
You stepped all over mine, man.
too.
Smooth Criminal, but I love the Alien Ant Farm version of that. Have you heard
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Alien Ant Farm does a great version of Smooth Criminal that that rocks. But, yeah.
Well, Dirty Diana rocks, too, but I have to say Smooth Criminal is, you know, but in terms of, I mean, I loved the Jacksons, and the Victory album from 1984 was
my first concert ever.
Awesome.
Was Victory.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
My first album, or actually cassette, was Thriller in 1982, 3, whatever.
Okay, my first cassette was Daryl Hall and John Oates' Voices with Kiss on My List.
Yeah, nice.
My first one was Weird Al Yankovic, Bad Hair Day.
Oh, yeah. comes back to Michael Jackson.
Yeah, all comes back.
He did all the Jackson parodies.
That's right. And you're wearing the glove right now, too, Rich. I'm glad that you brought it to
yes,
the show today.
I am.
All right, let's keep moving. We have a lawyer who is actually making a bomb threat. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so a Syracuse, New York lawyer is scheduled to appear in court this coming Friday, actually, to enter a plea to allegations that she phoned in a bomb threat to avoid a hearing regarding opposing counsel's request for sanctions against her. Jacqueline Jones was charged with what is a third-degree misdemeanor of falsely reporting an incident. The maximum penalty is a $100,000 fine and 1 year in jail. This incident happened in 2015 when she purportedly called in a bomb threat into a daycare at the courthouse. So the judge ultimately denied opposing counsel's sanction request, and her lawyer says that she's already written a letter of apology and has already paid a terrible price. I have to think that having to deal with a sanctions hearing is probably better than having to deal with the consequences of a false bomb threat, but, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, she got lucky. I mean, just when you think you've seen it all when it comes to dumb lawyer things, you see this. But, yeah, I can't say I've ever called in a bomb threat to avoid a court hearing.
All right, let's take a look at our next story. We have a DUI on a private driveway. Now, this is interesting to me. So they got drunk on their own driveway? What's happening with the story?
What's wrong with that, Mike Heideman asks.
Wow. What's this world coming to? So the Michigan Supreme Court held on July 24th that prosecutors can bring charges against a man who is accused of drunk driving on his own driveway. So in this case, a police officer had been called to investigate a noise complaint involving Gino Rea. And the officer approached Rea, who had been backing his car down the driveway, then saw the officer approaching, then pulled his car back up the driveway into his garage. Later testing of his blood alcohol level revealed that he was apparently over three times the legal limit. So this case seems to turn on how the state drunken driving law defines the act of being drunk behind the wheel, which is operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated upon a highway or other place open to the general public or generally accessible to motor vehicles. So because technically his driveway was accessible to other vehicles, he was found to violate the law. I just find this really an interesting case. I mean, I think really what's behind it is the desire to keep people off the road who are drunk. So may as well get them while they're on their driveway, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can't drive drunk without getting into your car in your driveway, right? I mean, if you're leaving from home, so makes sense to get them early. Of course, civil libertarians would argue that according to the, you know, very essence of DWI, you're missing the D, right? I mean, you're sitting in your driveway. Does that mean that someone who changes their mind, or what if someone fails the, you know, sobriety mechanism that you get installed in your car if you're, you know, violating? If you've been a violator of drunk driving, sometimes they put that device in your car. That means if you blow into that and your car doesn't start, technically you could still be arrested for drunk driving, right?
Right.
So, kind of strange, but Mike?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's like a slippery slope because, well, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I guess if you get in your car, you shouldn't get into it in the first place, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
Hasn't there been cases, though, where people are drunk and fallen asleep behind the wheel, parked, and they've gotten arrested for drunk driving as well? I thought I had heard something.
Yeah, I mean, that's happened again. Yeah. You know, the court, and remember, in this case, the defendant was three times the legal limit.
Yeah, that's
so I don't think there's much sympathy for this driver. But the court said that the driveway was designed for vehicular travel, as you mentioned. and that there's nothing preventing it, preventing another car from turning into it. So
yeah.
Does it stretch the limits of the law? Yes, but hey, for someone who's driving or potentially driving three times the amount of alcohol in their blood system, I'd rather have this happen than them get on the road.
I completely agree with you.
Exactly. Kudos to that officer that caught him in time, too. Wow. Right on the nose. He must have been keeping an eye on him or something like that. Let's finish up with our last story here. Olivia de Havilland?
No, it's Olivia de Havilland.
De Havilland.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the first time I've seen that
name. No worries.
There's a lawsuit regarding her. What's going on with this story?
Yeah, Olivia de Havilland is an actress who is 101 years old. She has been a fixture in Hollywood for many years. She's won 2 Academy Awards. And she was featured in the FX series Feud. Anyone see Feud? Feud got a lot of accolades. It featured, it was a story of Bette Davis against Joan Crawford, their feud. And she, Olivia de Havilland, was played in the film by Catherine Zeta-Jones. And she claims that she was portrayed without her permission. And she is asking the court to award her, money for that, for portraying her without her permission. She's asking for damages for violating her right of privacy. She's claiming unjust enrichment, that the producers, made money off her image. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. I'm going to defer to Christina in terms of the intellectual property importance of this, but it's also interesting because it features someone claiming that their advanced age should mandate that their case be fast-tracked. And this is common, frequently with older plaintiffs, you will see them petition the court to fast-track the case simply because they might not be around in the 2 to 3 years it takes for cases to wind themselves through the court system. And in this case, she's asking the L.A. Superior Court to set the trial within 120 days of the motion being granted. But in terms of the intellectual property, what do you think of that?
Well, no, I think it's very interesting. And I do think, I don't know all the specifics about exactly how she was portrayed, but I do know that she felt that it was damaging and hurtful to her reputation, and to do it without permission, I can understand why she filed suit, especially because she's had a very illustrious career. She was in Gone with the Wind, and she's, as you said, she's been one of the most preeminent and renowned actresses of a number of generations. So,
interestingly, we're talking to FX about the Legal Face-Off story. And we're talking to a variety of actors to see who'll play us.
Mm-hmm.
We're still talking to some actors for the Mike Heidemann role. we're in discussion.
How about Keanu Reeves?
Andre Agassi and Bruce Willis are both in contract negotiations for Rich Lenkoff's spot. Who would play Tina Martini in the?
I don't know.
In the Legal Face-Off story.
Come on, Rich, you come up with something. I gotta hear this.
We'll have someone
on,
under
guys.
Contract by our next show.
Yeah. Let's just say, is Olivia free? Just kidding. It'd be more like a Kate Beckinsale, I feel like.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, well, let's close up the Legal Grab Bag. It's been a great week. You can follow us at The Legal Face-Off on Facebook, at Legal Face-Off on Twitter, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes, tell a friend, spread the good word about The Legal Face-Off.
Sam Panjanovich.
Sam, we miss you.
We thank Mike and Craig Collins, of course, but Mike Heidemann for sitting in this week, and tune into Sound Sessions, right, on WGN?
Yes,
anytime. Mike and Kevin Richter. What's the latest episode?
The latest episode, we had Manchester Orchestra is playing a show here in Chicago, but we're going to be doing a lot of Lollapalooza coverage, so stay tuned for all of that.
Well, thanks for coming
in,
Mike.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having
me. Thanks.